Wake up, everyone. It's time for the Steve Noble Show, where biblical Christianity meets the everyday issues of life in your home, at work, and even in politics. Steve is an ordinary man who believes in an extraordinary God, and on his show, there's plenty of grace and lots of truth, but no sacred cows. Call Steve now at 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Or check him out online at thestevenobleshow.com. And now, here's your host, Steve Noble.
Welcome back. I hope you guys are doing well. Welcome back to the show. It's good to be here. I don't know how many weeks ago. It was not too long ago. The Friday morning Bible study, the men's Bible study that you guys hear me mention this occasionally. It's been going for about 40 years. Dr. Danny Lotz started that. You're like, who's Danny Lotz? Why does that matter? It's not so much Danny Lotz, although he was a phenomenal man of God, a dear friend of mine, a great mentor, and a huge blessing. But you probably know who his wife is. His wife is Ann Graham Lotz. Her dad is, some guy named Billy Graham or something. I'm not sure who that is. But anyway, so that Friday morning Bible study is a unique experience that is probably, from a fellowship perspective, one of the closest things to heaven I think I've experienced here on earth, because it's such a diverse group in many different ways, denominationally, ethnically, in terms of socioeconomic status, education. We've got ex-cons. We've got all kinds of people in there. And one of my good friends there, Russ, was talking to us about, and he's been bugging me for a while. You got to meet Reverend Ken. You got to meet Reverend Ken. And I never hear that. People never want me to meet anybody, so it's strange that he said it. But you got to meet Reverend Ken. Okay, why Russ? Why do I need to meet Reverend Ken? Because the Reverend marched in Selma with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He was going through training in Atlanta. He was there in the 20th row, mind you, in Washington, D.C., the March for Washington, when Dr. King gave the speech, which we played. Coincidentally, Ken played the entire speech on the show on MLK Day. I do that every year. And so a white pastor's foray into the civil rights movement back, obviously, in the 1960s. And so Ken came in. I was late to class that day. I missed pretty much everything you had to say. But then we had a chance to go out to breakfast afterwards, which I was grateful for. And it was just been wonderful to get to know you. And thank you for being in here today. Reverend Ken, how are you?
I'm doing good. It's an honor to be with you.
It's great to have you here. This is quite a story. And there's especially not a lot of white people that share this type of story with you, but it's something that I think we should all glean from because of what the Lord allowed you to experience and what he taught you through all of it. But let's go all the way back, because you were raised in Milford, Connecticut, and during the really some of the worst days in the civil rights atrocity here in America. What was that like for you as a child? Because was that real up there, or was it kind of off the radar screen?
Oh, no. It was very, very real. But my dad taught me very early on when I came out to the used car lot and worked in the used car lot, dusting cars, cleaning out trunks, lining up batteries, putting tires in order, and all that kind of stuff. He made it very clear when I came on the lot that everybody that came into the lot, everybody was to be respected equally, and everybody was important, and everybody was to be treated as special guests. And that's what that was no problem for me. Fine, that's what we did. We just did that.
And so when did you kind of become aware of just how bad things were in a significant portion of the country back then? Mm-hmm.
Well, it started working on the used car lot when people came in, and cars that we had sold had been shot up, and we had to go reclaim the cars and that kind of thing, and kind of gang war stuff. So very early on, at 16 and 17 and 18, it was really clear that we were really, really at war with one another in a nation, and it was a war racially divided, very racially divided, and very isolating, very isolating people.
And what year were you born?
1941. It was a good year.
Yeah.
I was born in an elevator.
Almost named Otis, right?
Yeah, right, for the elevator, right?
It's so funny. And so by the time you were it was the late 1950s, and you're 18 years of age and going off to college, and had a unique experience at college, because unlike going to college in the South, when you went to college at Ohio Wesleyan, would you say it was desegregated, or what was that like there?
No, it was not desegregated at all. I was a legacy to a large fraternity, and walked into that fraternity, and there was nothing but nude ladies' pictures and beer, and it was all over the place. I said, it's not fraternity for me. I walked across the street and across town, across the railroad tracks, and joined a fraternity called Beta Sigma Tau, which was opened internationally, interracially, interreligiously, and that was a place for me. That was a place where these are real people. It was really, so that's where I went as a freshman and loved working there and loved becoming president there and working in that whole community there.
Now, what was it like for African-American students at that school?
Well, at the school, if you were a freshman, a black freshman, male or female, you were in the furnace rooms down in the women's dorms or in the men's dorm. That's where the black students had to go, in the basement.
Literally in the basement.
In the basement, in the furnace room. And so our fraternity was the only fraternity at that time that had any Afro-American, had any Spanish, had anybody around from around the world. We were the only ones that were internationally recognized. We had the highest four-point accume of any fraternity in the, mm-hmm. In the campus because they all were very serious about their
serious
study.
Students there. Now, had you ever experienced that kind of segregation prior to getting there? That was at Ohio Wesleyan where okay, if you're black, you're sleeping in the basement by the furnace room.
Mm. No, although I recognized at the church where I grew up and became a United Methodist local preacher and all that kind of stuff, very white, very, very white. Nobody of any color. They had the color church. They were across the tracks, so they were down in another place in town. They were not in the main stream of Milford, Connecticut. So it was very white. That was very disturbing, actually.
Yeah. But for you personally, you were raised that – would you say that you were raised to kind of – we acknowledge that people are different. It's beautiful, that type of diversity. But did you struggle at all in that environment back then that, like a lot of people did, that literally looked at African-Americans as subservient, less than white Americans? Was that on your radar screen at all, or was that totally foreign to you then?
That's totally foreign, because on the used car lot, we had people, Spanish people, Afro-American people. We had all kinds of people from around the nation that were there coming through Bridgeport and Milford and Stratford and that kind of area. And so it was normal just to sit down and talk with somebody and have a conversation and learn who they were and what they were striving to do and how difficult it was for them to get loans and how difficult it was for them to get out of the trap that they were in. So that I heard a lot of that pain. Heard a lot of that pain.
I'm sure. Now, on campus, besides the fact that African-Americans as freshmen are forced to sleep literally in the basement of these buildings, what was it like just in classrooms and the atmosphere on campus back then?
Very segregated. Very segregated. They were just, I mean, really just tokens. They were just tokens on the campus. Some made it very well and did very well, but it was very token. It was very, very token. And our fraternity, like, you know, was the only one. They could go. They could join.
Yeah, so that was an oasis there at Ohio Wesleyan. Then when we come back and we're going to talk about an interesting opportunity. Well, we're going to talk about the FBI because the FBI got involved, interestingly enough. And then an experience that Reverend Ken had going down to Atlanta, which really is where God began to take him into the civil rights movement. And we're going to hear about all of that and Selma. It's an amazing story, so don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show. When we come back in from a commercial break, if you're ever wondering why we're kind of chuckling and laughing and it sounds like we've been having a little party while you've been listening to a commercial, that's because, well, we have been. So the only way you can experience that, you have to go to Facebook Live. So if you're a Facebook person, and hey, listen, the odds are that you're scrolling through your Facebook feed right now, somewhat listening to us, and then somewhat paying attention to what's going on in your Facebook feed, just go over to the Steve Noble Show on Facebook. You'll see the little Facebook Live icon and the little play button, and just click it. And you'll be right here in the studio with us. So while you on the radio are listening to a commercial break, which is super important, that's the way we fund a lot of these things on radio. In the studio, we have kind of a sidebar conversation. I don't rob from you listening on radio. I don't rob from you what's happening during the breaks. We just have kind of a separate conversation. Maybe we take a little bit of a digression. We pick up on a different, slightly different subject. We tell some stories, but that's another 13 or 14 minutes of what's going on between 4 and 5 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday. So the only way you're going to get that is either you watch the Facebook Live feed later or you just jump on it and join us here in the studio right now. So that's 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern time. We're doing Facebook Live right now in the studio here in Wake Forest on the campus of Southeastern Baptist. Reverend Ken Steigler is with me today. All right, so that's German.
Yes, Steigler.
S-T-E-I. How many people spell it S-T-I-E-G-L-E-R?
They spell it sprinkler, stinkler. We've had lots of stuff.
You've been down all those roads. Reverend Ken has got involved at a pretty young age when he was in college and had a chance to go down to Atlanta, which we're going to talk about next, and ended up going to Selma and was there in Washington, D.C. and wrote like Row 20 when Dr. King gave his I Have a Dream speech. So this is a story of a young follower of Christ who happens to be white that had an experience that many of us never had a chance to have, all of us should have. And so we're just going to kind of vicariously learn through what the Lord did with you. But you were there in school. You were at Ohio Wesleyan. You had some token African-Americans on campus on most of the fraternities and places. Freshman year, they're sleeping in the basement, literally, which sounds horrible, and I'm sure it was. But at one point, why did the FBI come check you guys out? What was up with that?
Well, unfortunately, the seniors at the time, I was a sophomore in the fraternity, and the seniors decided they wanted to have a party. All the campuses always had parties. They had all kinds of drinking parties, but we don't do that. So they wanted to have what they called a communist party.
Oh. Well, and that would be more popular today, unfortunately, than perhaps it was
right
back then.
Well, with two John Birch societies in where we were in Delaware, Ohio, they didn't take kindly to the fact that we were advertising, apparently, in the community to come to this communist party. And it was just supposed to be a party communing together. I mean, that's what it's supposed to be. Yeah. Well, so the FBI had to come in.
Oops.
And they investigated the officers, and why did you do such a thing, and why would you support such a thing, and don't you know it's causing dissension in this community? Yes. So we had that chaplain who was our chaplain. He was the leader of our fraternity in terms of the campus. He came in and stood in for us and indicated that this was just a simple little fun thing that this fraternity, and he would assure the FBI that we weren't
going to
do anything like
that. Well, an interesting foreshadow there. I mean, there's some good humor in that one, but an interesting foreshadow of dealing with law enforcement later, because how did the whole invitation to come down to Atlanta and the training and everything there while you were in school at Ohio Wesleyan?
That came because Miss Willie, who was the head of the social the committee on pastoral counseling, and she was the professor for that, and Dr. Butler Jones was the professor for sociology, happened to be my double major, and they decided they wanted to have two cigar kind of cars down and do a tour to see what was going on in 1962. So we went to Atlanta, and we went to Albany, and we went to Tuskegee. We went to a number of different places. But Atlanta is where we met Dr. King.
Well, you grew up in Connecticut. You're going to school in Ohio. Now you're going down to Atlanta, and it's 1962.
Mm-hmm.
So what was that like, and what did you learn down there?
Well, with Dr. King, there was a social gathering from about 7 or 8 o'clock at night, started a social gathering at a house, and we just waited for Dr. King and the group to come. They came at 10 o'clock at night, and they had to come late because of concerns of their safety and all those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Which we understood. We knew it was going to be awkward for him to come in the daytime right to this house. So anyway, it was a good time. And we sat down and we listened to him and talked with him, question and answer, for a good hour. And after we did that, Hosea Williams was there and trained us, because we asked if we could do something, act out in the community just a little bit to get a feel for what this is like, you know. And so a group of us got trained to go into and do a sit-in in the local restaurant that was known for...
What did you have to be trained to do?
We had to train to be protecting one another. We had to train to keep our focus on Jesus Christ. That was the focus. You keep your focus on Jesus Christ. You love everybody that's around you, no matter what you hear or what they do. You're going to love them. And that's a strong discipline you have to develop. And we were trained to... If somebody got attacked, we were trained to kind of slide up with them so that two or three people would take a beating or take the ammonia rag that was in the waitress's belt and all that kind of stuff. So we did. The next day, a small group of us went in, black and white. We all went in the front door. That caused a little bit of ruckus, to say the least. We all sat down at the very front of the counter and all that kind of stuff, and we just asked for a glass of water. Each of us just asked, can we have a glass of water? Well, that riled up the crowd that was there, that riled up the owner, that riled up the waitress with her swinging ammonia rag. And we could see it was just not going well, because it was just rowding up. And we didn't want to create an incident for Ohio Wesleyan University.
Yeah.
We were only there to kind of see what it was like. Well, we got a good taste of what it was like.
What did that do to you?
Well,
because I would assume you've never experienced anything like that up to that point in your life.
No, not anything like that. But we were told by Hosea, this is what's going to happen, and he was very right. That's what happened, and he said, now if you don't want to cause a scene, sit, ask for a glass of water, and if it's refused, and you sense the atmosphere is turning angry, then you have to go. And they were angry, yelling and swearing and stuff, and that wasn't pleasant. And then we all walked out the front door again, which caused a little bit more anger, and lots of words and stuff were shared. And then we walked back to where we were being trained at that house. And that was we had a debrief with them because we had never experienced anything like that.
What kind of impact did that have on you? I mean, you're seeing one of the worst sides of humanity, mm-hmm. especially in the American context. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not terribly abnormal in other places around the world, but in America, coming down from the north, mm-hmm. to what did that do to you? And it's one thing to, we know we're supposed to love our neighbor. We know we're supposed to pray for those who persecute us, that they ask you to go a mile, you go two. They ask for your shirt, you give them your tunic also. We know all that stuff, but but it's one thing to study it and read about it. It's another thing to actually have to do it. Mm-hmm. So how did that impact you?
Well, I can remember, I mean, I can go back and just close my eyes and I can picture the whole scene easily. We got back, and the thing that happened to me very much was I was even more determined to be part of this movement that was a movement to say that racial inequality and segregation and racism and hatred was not the way for the nation to go. It was just not the way. That I was, Dr. King was very, very clear. If we don't change the nation, who's going to change the nation? And we do it with nonviolence. And so that was a very important lesson to learn, to be nonviolent, discipline. Learn that discipline.
Yeah, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about you went off to Boston University School of Theology, and then Dr. King actually called there in preparations for the march at Selma. And then I want to talk about prayer, because I know that had that was pretty radical, revolutionized your understanding of prayer and how that was such a huge part of what was going on with the movement back then. This is Steve Noble with Dr. Reverend Ken Steigler. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show, talking today to a new friend, but an eternal friend. You're stuck with me, Ken. Sorry. Reverend Ken Steigler, who has just an amazing story, God's grace in allowing him to be a part of the civil rights movement back in the 60s and to march on Selma. He was in the 20th row in Washington, D.C. when Dr. King gave his now a famous speech that is just one of the most amazing speeches uttered by any human being ever. In Washington, D.C. So he was there for that, and this has had a profound impact on him, and he's been teaching and sharing and talking about it ever since. And so I had a chance to get to know him recently, and then obviously bringing you on the air was a no-brainer. Also, there's something coming up actually next week. You guys are leaving on Monday.
Yes.
6 seats left. This is in conjunction with Friendship Chapel Baptist Church in Wake Forest and one of the United Methodist Churches here in Wake Forest. Tell us about that real quick, because I know we're going to give some details later, but this is a pretty incredible opportunity.
Well, it's an opportunity because the MLK Committee, which is was chartered and commissioned by the HR Committee, the Human Relations Committee, after 25 years of being in existence, to do something more spectacular this year than just recognition of Dr. King and having a service at the church. And the committee asked them to have a trip to the Freedom Trail. And so that's what they, when I came back in October, I chaplained at another place, and we came back in October and said, we need you to come and help us because you have a lot of background and knowledge and stuff. So my privilege has been to work with the MLK committee, work with Jim Grant and his wife Margot, Laurie Moss, and Peggy Blake as a committee. And they have been doing great things, putting together a wonderful tour. And there are, right now there are just six seats left out of 50. And the rooms are already paid for, so there are 6 seats left. And anybody who wants to know about it can come tonight at Wake Forest in Wake Forest at the Friendship Chapel Baptist Church.
This is basically leaving Monday morning very early. You return Thursday. This is all next week, Monday through Thursday. And what are you going to see? So what are the stops?
Wow. We're going to go to Atlanta and see the wall mural of the civil rights movement. We're going to go to the birthplace for Dr. King. We're going to go to Ebenezer Church, and there's a national National Parks person who's going to give a presentation of what the church was and what Dr. King did at Ebenezer Church. And then we're going to go from there because it's going to be late, because we're going to just get there about probably 1 o'clock and then do all these things, and then we're going to go back to Montgomery, where we're going to spend the night for the first night, and then start out the next day.
And, we'll and Montgomery's where the major civil rights museum is down there, right?
Yes. And then we're going to do all the museums. There was a Parks Museum. We're going to do the Civil Rights Museum. Mm-hmm. Everything that we can possibly do in Montgomery. We're going to do where the slaves were sold in the slave market, where Rosa Parks was a part of the where she lived, you know, did her work and all that kind of stuff, and where she got on the bus. We'll do that. On our bus going down, by the way, we always save seat number 9 for Rosa Parks. Mm. That's always that's always what we do when we go down on the bus. And everybody says, why is the seat empty? And the seat is empty because we want to remember and have the students remember and the folks remember this is where Rosa Parks sat, way up front here. And when we go down, usually, as people will find out, a lot of white folks are sitting in the back and a lot of Afro-American folks are sitting in the front.
Yeah, interesting. And then Thursday morning, Tuskegee Airmen and all that, and then head back up.
Right.
It's $325. The only thing it doesn't include is your dinner, so you would leave Monday morning, come back Thursday night. And if you're interested in that, there's only 6 seats left. It's really an incredible opportunity, and Ken will be leading that, one of the leaders of the trip himself. So I'm going to give you his email address if you're interested. I know it's last minute, but what a huge blessing. If I could go, I would. but unfortunately, not this time, but I would definitely want to do this in the future. Just send him an email, okay? It's Rev G Ken. So R-E-V-G-K-E-N. Rev G Ken at gmail.com. And just send him an email if you're interested. But do it soon, okay? There's only 6 seats left. Rev G Ken, K-E-N, at gmail.com. So after Ohio Wesleyan and your experience in Atlanta and going through all of that, then you went to Boston University, the School of Theology. And then actually Dr. King called. Mm-hmm. Because Selma was coming up. What all happened there?
Well, Bloody Sunday happened, and Dr. King called because he went the next couple of days later, and he went up to the bridge again and could see that there was a trap. It was just a trap. And so he called, and he spoke to Dean Milder, and he said to Dean Milder, I need clergy down here wearing collars, and I need a lot. I need 2 buses full of clergy. And so the dean called me, and I didn't know why it was being called into the dean's office. Mm-hmm. Then he called me in and said, you're social concerns chair. I said, yes, sir, I am. And what am I supposed to do? He said, you're going to be in charge of the 2 buses, Harvard Divinity School, Andover Newton Seminary, and BU. We're all going to pile in, and we're going to go down on this Monday. We're going down to Selma to be with Dr. King because he needs help, and he needs clergy wearing collars. So that was one of the first times that I, other than a funeral, I ever wore a collar. So it was my honor and real privilege to lead the group. We left very, very early on the morning, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. We went through Barrage.
Wasn't there something you had to do before you got on the bus?
Well, yes, we had to give the dean our last will and testament. And we had to hand the dean. He wouldn't let anybody go on the bus from BU that didn't hand in their, at least the recognition or the writing that they had at last will and testament. And so,
Was just a recognition of the reality of that it most likely be violent.
Well, what he said, we're not sure you're all going to come back or any of you are coming back. So that was a little, hot wrenching to say the least.
Yeah, to say the least.
But that's what we did. We just got on the bus and we got.
Did your parents know you were going?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my mom and dad knew a lot about
it. Anybody try to talk you out of it?
No. They knew better, actually.
Well, you are German, after all.
Yeah, very, very, very. Yeah, right.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, right, very persistent. We went down and got clobbered with vegetables and stones on the bus and stuff, but we made it there.
Just pulling in there.
Coming through the overducts, they were over the viaduct. Yeah. And we were under travel on the road. We were bombarded, not big rocks, but lots of gravelly kind of thing. It was a little earth shaking,
yes.
To say the least. We just sang and prayed. We just knew, We got down, and the people we saw at Brown Chapel were standing there. We thought they were all going to be in crutches and bandages and stuff. Nope. There was a few people in crutches and bandages, but the rest of the people were standing there singing and praising and worshiping the Lord. And we got off. It was, stunning. It was stunning. The photographers were there from all kinds of media and that kind of thing. So the 2 bus loads, we unloaded. When we went into the Brown Chapel, the people who were sitting in the front all stood up and moved out of the front of the church so we could go down to the front of the church and be right in the presence of Dr. King and all the folks, Ralph and everybody that was there. That was very moving. They would give up the front seat. We were going to sit in the back or stand around. But they wanted us to come right in the front. They wanted us to have an experience with a presence there. and with great Dr. King preach. I don't remember the message that time, but Dr. King's preaching was always dynamic and heartfelt and spirit led. It's awful. It was powerful, awesome. So then, after a couple hours of that, we were really kind of fading a lot. By 9 o'clock at night, we were really
pooped. Yeah,
we were pooped. And so we, Dr. King closed the meeting, and we thought, we can go to where we're going to sleep. So no, there was going to be all night prayer meeting. And so because I was privileged to be the leader of the group, the pastor of the church was going to be where I was going to stay. So he said, you can stay just a little bit. I said, yeah, I'll stay with you just a little. But the rest of the groups all went to either churches or to homes. And I went to the pastor's home, where he typed up for me a letter to send to all the parishioners in Marston's Mills, thinking, and I brought letters and ready to send with stamps and everything. And we ran that off and got it ready for the mail the next morning. And the next morning, first thing right off, we put it in the mail, and we came to the Brown Chapel. And when we came there, the students who had their house where they were staying shot out. The first floor was all shot out by the Ku Klux Klan. They all wanted to leave because they said they didn't want to come to Selma and be shot dead in a bed. They wanted to walk and make a difference in voting rights and that kind of thing. So I went to talk to Martin, and I said, please, the whole group is ready. They're ready to run. They're terrified. The house got shot out and all that kind of stuff. So he came over and had the newspaper, and the newspaper had a big picture of us on the front of the Selma News.
Oh, boy.
And it said, Northern agitators arrive.
Wow.
And we hadn't seen it, but he saw it.
You don't come across as an agitator.
Well, anyway, that's good. And his message for a good 45 minutes was about it takes agitation to get the dirty wash clean. Mm-hmm. And he quoted from Isaiah and Ezekiel, he just quoted prophet after prophet, what the prophets had to do. And we were there in a prophetic moment. It was powerful, powerful. Everybody said, okay. And so we got trained again at how to do cluster. If you got beaten, one person, you clustered together.
Yeah, get together.
We got together. We learned.
Well, hold that thought right there. What about the role of prayer in all this?
Dr. King did nothing ever without lots of prayer. All night prayer meetings, prayer and fasting. I learned to pray. I really learned to pray with Dr. King, because what I had learned before, you read prayers and there pray the best that you know, but no, you have to. With Dr. King, it was pray from your heart. Listen to what God is saying to you and pray from your heart, and pray like you're right in the presence of the Lord. It was like that was so different. It was just so revolutionary in my whole life.
Yeah, because all of a sudden you've got that Isaiah experience and you're in the throne room, as opposed to just kind of a stale. And I'm saying liturgical, not in a negative connotation way, but kind of sterile, kind of formal, as opposed to let's talk to the man that chose to die on a cross for you, who loves you and is with you and will never leave you nor forsake you, and he's right there with you. That's a totally different type of prayer than a lot of us have experienced. We're going to keep talking about that and where it all went from there and how we ended up together today. We'll be right back. 'Cause you are more. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show. So glad you're with us today. A conversation we don't get to have very often with somebody that most of us would never meet, somebody like Reverend Ken Stigler. He was grew up in a white context as a Caucasian man in Connecticut, and went to Ohio Wesleyan, ended up at Boston University School of Theology, but had an opportunity to go to Atlanta and get some training with Dr. King and with Jesse Jackson, and went the whole movement down there, and actually went back when he was at Boston University in the School of Theology, to go down to Selma. Bloody Sunday had happened, and then Dr. King called up there and said, we need a couple buses of clergy, people with collars, to have that type of presence when they were going to be crossing that bridge again. So the day comes for that march on Selma, and Ken, what was that like? Kind of take us into there as much as you can.
Okay, here's the training. We did a whole week of training. We went to the courthouse. And we did black, white, black, white, black, white in a line in groups of 10 to go to the courthouse to help people register to vote. That's what we were doing that whole week before the march started. And the people were turned away because they couldn't read German, or they couldn't read French, and they couldn't read Italian. But white folks went, and they could read Dick and Jane. But the Afro-American people just did not get that book. They got a book in another language. So that was the training. And here's what happened. As the coordinator for the group, the two buses, I promised my mother and father on that Saturday that was I was going to remarry them for their 25th wedding anniversary. I was 23 years old. I was going to remarry. So I prayed with the group, and a couple of other wonderful brothers took over the leadership of the group, and I got on a plane wearing a GROW button, which stood for Get Rid of Wallace. Was very unpopular in a plane. And I took the button off my pocket so I didn't get throttled on the plane. Got there in time to remarry my mom and dad. Now, they went on the march. I was able to pray with them and send them forth, and all with the blessing of the BU seminary and all that kind of stuff. But I had to get back to marry mom and dad. I did that in Norfolk, Connecticut. Then I drove back the next morning to the parsonage in Marston's Mills, and was quite surprised at this little teeny church where I was just a brand new student pastor there. And I was surprised to see all my belongings on the front yard, out in the front yard. And one of the trustees indicated that they didn't want a mornig for a pastor. I had never heard that.
They didn't want a what?
They didn't want a mornig for a pastor.
Now, what is that?
More nigger than nigger. And I had never experienced that. I never even heard that in the used car lot. I'd never heard that anywhere.
Yeah, because you're coming back from this righteous cause. Mm. And to them, you're just like, might as well be the devil himself.
Well, and the reason it spurred their negativity was I'd sent that letter from Selma,
yeah,
thinking it was going to be a really very significant historical document. I thought it would be so important for them for history. And so only one person, actually, one of the teachers in the school thought it was very important.
Wow.
But everybody else, they were furious. They were furious. And I learned a little bit after that, too, that there was a Ku Klux Klan meeting in Mashpee right next door to Marston's Mills where I was. And so they had really put a lot of poison into their hearts.
Wow.
So anyway, everything was out, and I called the bishop. Bishop called the district superintendent. District superintendent came down. I couldn't go to the meeting. And I don't know what the district superintendent said, and nobody ever told me, but the men came back about 8:30 at night and asked where to put everything back in the house.
Wow.
And here's what I did know, what was told. I said, why are you all here? The bishop said, you're not leaving until we love you. And that took 4 years of work in ministry.
Goodness.
And we just worked together, and they found out that I was just a loving pastor in training in pastoral counseling as well as in just theological training. And so I did a lot of counseling with a lot of very harsh situations
in
the community. And so we worked it out.
What was it like to be in D.C. for the I Have a Dream speech?
Oh.
And you had pretty good seats, too.
Yeah.
20th row.
Yeah, right. I was right up front there. It was unbelievable. I had a lot of friends from BU that wanted to come down, so I made arrangements with the United Methodist Church to go to the homes of people. And when they went into the homes of people there, they were getting rifles, they were getting pistols, and it was going to be... And people I stayed with that had pistols and rifles, and they knew there was going to be a big revolution. It was going to be awful and terrifying. And I said, no, it's not. It's going to be peaceful. It was extremely peaceful.
Yeah.
And the thing they took pictures of at the end of it all was, they didn't take their trash away. Well, there were trash barrels, but there's only a few trash barrels for thousands of people.
Yeah.
Of course, there was trash all piled around. That was one of the takes in Washington, D.C. The trash. The black people are just coming here, and the white agitators are coming here and trashing our nation's capital.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't true. It just wasn't true.
When he gave the speech, did you have any indication at the time just how historic that was going to be?
Oh,
this is one of the most famous speeches in the history of mankind.
It was riveting. There was a silence, and there was a amening, and it was riveting. You could tell that he had been to the mountaintop and he had heard from the Lord, and this is what the Lord put on his heart. And he just shared powerfully. It was so powerful.
How did that hit you, and how did you find out that Dr. King had been assassinated?
Well, I got a call. I got a call because of some of the folks that I knew and stuff, and Snick and Slick and all that. I got a call right away and asked if I could come, and I just didn't have the money. I just really... I was only getting $50 a week serving as a student pastor,
wow.
And I just did not have the money.
Was there a sense of inevitability? Did people think, surely somebody's going to try to kill Dr. King one of these days?
I'll just read one quick little thing.
Sure.
Dr. King prayed this prayer, this little prayer. Oh, sorry. This is after receiving the telephone call. He received about 40 calls a day when he was at home and Dexter Parsonage and all. But anyway, he received a call. Anyway, here's the prayer. He was sitting at the kitchen table, and this is the prayer that he prayed. Lord, I am here taking a stand for what I believe is right. but now I am afraid. The people are looking to me for leadership, and if I stand before them without strength and courage, they too will falter. I am at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I've come to the point where I can't face it alone. In Jesus' name, amen.
Man.
That was a prayer at his kitchen table, and it was recorded because it was that was the turning point, because he was really, his life was so threatened, but he just had to give it all to the Lord, total surrender, and just made the decision that no matter what it cost, he was going to go forward.
Yeah. What would you have all of us listening today, and what would you have us learn from what you learned? Mm-hmm. What would you pass on to all of us? And there's white people listening, black people listening, Hispanics, just people that say they love the Lord. What do we take away from your experience?
Well, the thing I would say is we need to be disciplined enough to totally surrender our lives. And it takes an enormous discipline. It's not an easy thing to walk through the places where the dogs and the bats and the guns. And we went to Atlanta Airport on the way coming back from that trip from Wesley, and we had to walk through a complete corridor of National Guard because the people on the airport there where we had lunch were all there with chains and clubs and wrenches and stuff, and we had to be protected to go through a whole corridor of military personnel. So the thing I would say is, well, we have come a little, but we are not there. We are not there where we really love and respect and have learned how to total surrender our lives to Jesus Christ and walk in a godly, Christ-like way, not just saying the words, but living it out in community and walking together with our brothers and sisters.
Yeah, because I think one of the challenges is because life in 21st century America in 2020 doesn't look the way it did in 1962. Mm-hmm. And so where things were much more obvious then, just in terms of those clashes and Bloody Sunday and everything that was going on, today I think it's not quite as obvious as it was back then. And so I think, and I asked you this question when we had breakfast before, where it has the appearance of being so much better. Mm-hmm. But how do you look at it? Because I know that you don't really see it that way.
Mm-hmm. No, the poverty level in the black community is awful. The fact that African-American men have been really, excuse the language, have been really castrated by our society as not being worthwhile, and leave their families because they feel hopeless and they feel helpless and they feel castrated, they feel absolutely destroyed. And so they don't have the self-confidence because they were taught that you can't look to the white, you can't look them in the eye, you can't talk them face-to-face, you can't look at a white woman. And I still see that. I still see a lot of Afro-American men with their heads, when you say hello, they put their heads down. Mm-hmm. And I asked them to stop. I said, please, I want to see you face-to-face. And I try everywhere I can to say, you're not under that kind of regime any longer.
We don't live there anymore.
We're free. We're freer to do this. And voting is so important. Everywhere I go in the Afro-American, I try to share. Please get out and vote. Get out and vote. Get out and vote. It cost a lot of people their lives.
Such a sacred honor to be able to do that. And we don't have that perspective as Americans because we lack the context.
Right.
If I don't like, they're all scumbags, whatever. To your point, you have no idea what people suffered in order to give us the opportunity. Whether you're African-American, white, your age, women. I mean, it took an amendment to the U.S. Constitution to give women the right to vote as well as African-Americans the right to vote.
Right.
This has been, we talk about blood spilled for our freedoms. The freedom to vote is one of those. Mm-hmm. It's spilled not only by soldiers, mm-hmm. but by people marching in the street.
Mm-hmm. And I had the honor of working with the Black Panthers in New Bedford when that riot broke out years ago. And the reason I worked with the Black Panthers is I worked with a priest, and he was going to work with the police, and he said, you've got to work with the Black Panthers. You had training with Dr. King. So, you know, I did. It was a real privilege to work with them because they really were very... They could be very, very decent men, but they were very angry and frustrated.
Yeah, talk about a tough counseling situation. Hey, let's go get the white reverend who was trained by Dr. King to come talk to the Black Panthers. Wow, you've had a really interesting life. I don't think anybody could make that one up. By the way, and again, there's six seats left going next Monday, literally next Monday, on this five-day tour, Civil Rights Tour, and Reverend Ken is going to be one of the leaders on that. So if you want to find out about it, it's only $325. That includes everything except your dinner. RevGKen@gmail.com, and we've also put it up on Facebook. RevGKen@gmail.com. Ken, I can't thank you enough for coming in and sharing. Let's do it again, okay?
Because we didn't have
enough time, nearly.
Thanks, Steve.
God bless you. You're welcome. This is Steve Noble on The Steve Noble Show. God willing, I'll talk to you again real soon. And like my dad always used to say, ever forward.